Hello, everybody in the United States, Israel, Palestine, other places in the world. My name is David Myers. I'm a professor of Jewish history at UCLA in Los Angeles. I'm also the board president of the New Israel Fund. And I'm delighted to welcome you all to this latest installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine, hosted by Partners for Progressive Israel. I'll be moderating a conversation with two prominent Israeli activists, Yael Patir and Ori Zaki. I want to say just a word about Conversations with Israel and Palestine. It is a series of informational webinars that brings voices from Israel and Palestine to an American audience, providing an important link between progressives in the United States and the Middle East. Before we get started, let me just note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit 501c3 organization that is devoted to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and believes in the need to ensure civil rights, equality, and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. Partners seek to deepen Americans, and especially American Jews, understanding of Israel's complexities in order to enhance the ability to advocate for a progressive Israeli future. And now I'm really pleased to welcome our two conversation partners today. First, Yael Patir, who is the Israel director for J Street, which she joined in 2012 after 6 years at the Shimon Peres Center for Peace, where she served as director of the Civil Leadership Department. Yael also helped establish the Palestinian-Israeli Peace NGO Forum, which is a network of some 100 Palestinian and Israeli peace and dialogue organizations. And she served as the Israel director of the forum since its inception in 2006. Yael is a certified mediator and a group facilitator specializing in dialogue between groups in conflict. And now Ori Zaki, I'm pleased to welcome. Ori has focused his career on promoting peace and democratic values. He was a senior advisor to former Justice Minister Yossi Beilin and was part of the negotiating team of the Geneva Initiative. Ori was the founding director of B'Tselem USA and later director of Zionist Enterprises at the World Zionist Organization. He is a leading figure in the Meretz Party, where he held the position of president of the governing assembly. And today, Ori leads the Front for the Protection of Democracy, which acts as an assertive attack dog against the Israel alt-right and its anti-democratic infrastructure. So we'll no doubt drill down on the attack dog designation. Yael, Ori, and I are going to chat for about 40 minutes or so about the state of progressive politics in Israel and the world, and what we as progressive Americans, Jews and non-Jews, can do to make a difference. After that, we'll be open for questions, and I just want to say a word about how you can pose a question. At any point, you can type in your questions by looking at the bottom of your screen for the icon that reads Q&A. You may need to touch your screen or run your mouse over it. You may want to try that now. Then click on the icon and type your question in the small box that appears there. The webinar won't disappear or be disrupted by your posing a question. Your microphones are turned off, and questions only can be asked when typed in this way, but you will not be disrupting. And I encourage you to formulate your questions from the early stages of our conversation and send them along whenever you're so inspired. So let's set the stage for the conversation. Later today, the United States House of Representatives will vote on two articles of impeachment against Donald Trump. Trump and his allies represent, in the eyes of many of us, I think, on this call, the United States version of the global scourge of illiberal democracy, a political ideology and practice that rest on an ethnocentric, xenophobic form of nationalism based on exclusion rather than inclusion, intolerance rather than tolerance, and power rather than justice. Israel, as we know, is a link in this chain of global illiberalism. The last decade, which I often think of simply as the Netanyahu decade, has drawn amply from this playbook of illiberal democracy. Attacks on the rule of law, on an independent judiciary, on the free press, on political opponents, on the rights of minorities, on the rights of the most vulnerable, like asylum seekers. And it's important to note that pushing in this direction towards the Israeli version of neoliberalism has been what we can only call a motley assembly of right-wing American Jewish, and for that matter, Christian actors. So they have infused huge amounts of money in the direction of the settlement project, and have in that regard really perpetuated and dug deeper roots for the occupation. They have supported organizations intent on attacking institutions of democracy in Israel, as well as progressive social justice actors. And that's something that we at NIF and J Street know very well. A central figure, of course, in that particular aspect of right-wing support is Sheldon Adelson, who has bankrolled, among many other things, Israel's most widely disseminated newspaper, Yisrael Hayom, Israel Today, which I sort of think of as Israel's version of Pravda. And right-wing actors from America have also played a key role in generating, disseminating, lobbying for, and legislating ideas that support the ethnocentric vision. And here, I think the classic example is Israel's nation state law passed by the Knesset in July 2018, which was the product of a concerted, and I would have to say, enviably successful decade of work by right-wing think tanks funded by American Jewish philanthropists, including and especially the Tikva Fund. But if there is a global network of illiberal Democrats, there's also a global network of progressive liberal Democrats. We may be at present less organized or less well-funded, but we exist, and we exist in considerable numbers, and we must now marshal our resources and fortify our collaborations. In this regard, it seems to me that the divide that is emerging, or that in fact has emerged, is not so much between Israel and America, as, for example, Daniel Gordas has recently argued. It's between liberals and illiberals, both of whom are to be found in substantial numbers in Israel, in the United States, and in many places around the world. And this brings me now to our two distinguished panelists, Yael and Uri, who can help us understand what they think needs to be done in this challenging era. Challenging indeed, but one in which we begin to see, at least in the Israeli case, some glimmer of hope, or at least some glimmer of change on the horizon. And so I'd open up by asking Yael and then Uri, where are we today? Donald Trump faces imminent impeachment and then likely subsequent acquittal in the United States. Boris Johnson won a smashing victory in the United Kingdom. These two developments push in the direction of that further movement toward the illiberal side of the spectrum. And now Israel goes to a third set of elections in which Netanyahu seems to be hanging on by a thread. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts about where we are in sort of this global moment of illiberalism, of xenophobia, of ethnocentrism, and more particularly where Israel is within that that wider setting. So maybe we'll begin with Yael. Welcome, and thank you for agreeing to be with us.
Thank you. So let me first start by thanking the organizers for putting this call together and for giving me the honor of sharing the conversation with David and Uri, who I very much appreciate and learn from. I think the good news from Israel is that we are definitely at the end of the Netanyahu era. While it's not clear how, you know, how the clock is exactly going to run and how much time we do have, it is clear that the decade, the Netanyahu decade, as David, as you described, is coming to an end. That does not mean that illiberalism in Israel is coming to an end. That, I think, is very much a political, it would be a political consequence and has to do a lot with how politics will unfold. I think one of the things that we are seeing with much disgust, I have to say, is the way in which the Likud party is behaving. And and we're seeing the same kind of developments happening within the Republican Party, where you don't see dissent. There is this tendency of forming one line, which usually people on the right are much better in doing than people on the left, and uniting behind the leader. I mean, when you, if you hear Likud members of Knesset and ministers in interviews in the radio, they talk about Netanyahu as if he's this supreme leader. They actually use, when they use, you know, Hamanhig, you have to stand behind the Manhig, and it sounds as if they're talking about this king or dictator. It's you listen to it and you say, do you hear yourself? Do you hear the tone? It's really unbelievable, and it makes all of us, I'm sure, as well as the viewers, feel extremely concerned about Israeli democracy. And the question is whether the end of Netanyahu will also mean the end of these trends that have penetrated throughout, institutions and have been legitimized. I do see a lot of hope. Also, I see the pendulum. I see a reaction, which I think we see more recently. And I'm happy to talk about that some more. But I'm going to give the microphone to Uri, so we can really have this be more of a lively conversation.
Great, thank you, yeah. Uri, how do you see it?
First of all, I wanna join Yael by thanking both PPI, whom I know for many years, and they're doing a great job, and also you, David. I said in our last panel at J Street that without NIF, thank God for NIF, because without NIF, there would be nothing. And I still think so. And really, it's a great honor for you moderating this discussion for us. I of course agree with everything that Yael said before. Yes, we are in an era that somehow in Israel started earlier than the rest of the world. You know, it's very interesting. I saw today that Netanyahu shared a piece by Breitbart saying that his whole, that a former U.S. prosecutor, whatever, saying that his cases are nothing and is being persecuted instead of prosecuted or whatever. You know, Netanyahu was the one who came up with the idea of forming Breitbart. I mean, he had these people over in Israel something like 12 years ago or 11 years ago, telling them, you know, what you need to do is to form a news website. And that's how linked everything is. And, we're speaking now when on the other screen, I'm sure many of our participants in this webinar are also keeping an eye to what's going on at the House of Representatives and whether or not, and we do know the consequences, as you mentioned, David, that Trump will be impeached in the House and will be acquitted in the Senate. It's all political. I think it's part of this era. And, you know, Netanyahu, I think there is a gradual, how would I call it, worsening of his the way he acts as a populist leader. Netanyahu at the end of the at the beginning was someone who was respecting the rule of law, democracy, and everything. But ever since he got into power, he had this divisive manner to him. Since 2015, when he won the elections against all odds, he then kind of got rid of his old establishment direction and went into a truly populistic, divisive, attacking the infrastructure of democracy. And that came along with a kind of a hubris that I think is in the core of the indictments against him. I mean, if you look at it, most of these things happened after his, or either very close or just after his victory in 2015, which for him was kind of a signal that he can do whatever he wants. He's truly a king. You know, there was this famous King Bibi cover of the Time magazine. He felt like he has no restraints, nothing. He can do whatever he wants. And that came also in a time where in the rest of the world, I mean, not long after Trump won the in the United States, which I think was really unleashing the kind of legitimacy. I mean, the effect of Trump's election, I think, is enormous. You can't compare the world and those populist leaders before and after Trump was elected, because and it affects everything. It affects social media. It affects what you're allowed and not allowed to say on social media. What is an accepted language? How you treat your rivals, making them enemies. Who are your rivals? This whole notion of the deep state, which penetrated. You know, there's a famous Israeli pundit called Daniel Segal who talks about the deep shtetl, right? It penetrates so deeply into the discourse, and there's a kind of a going back and forth, nurturing each other. I mean, if you take Bibi's in close contact, of course, with Trump, as I said before, also with the Trump infrastructure, whether it's the fake news media, whether it is the the moguls who finance both Trump and Netanyahu and so on and so forth. Of course, also evangelical Christians that we can talk about in this discussion. On the other hand, he's also keeping a very, very close touch with Urban from Hungary, with Modi from India, and all of them are somehow connected and showing off their contacts with Putin, who is, I think, at the end of the day, the source of all this development, because Putin proved that, you know, you can have, you can, you know, win technically in a democracy. I mean, Putin, when he wanted, you know, he respected the law that said that you can't be, you can't serve more than two times in a row as a president. He went to become a prime minister for a while, then came back as a president. And I think he's the source of all this notion of other leaders, and sometimes also, as we know, interfered, at least in the American elections, and I would think that in other places as well. To conclude this part, I would just say that if we talk about Israel and the United States, there's definitely much more than just money. You know, we're used to this concept of philanthropists coming from the United States financing causes here. It's much closer. I think it's also a cooperation of causes developing each other's causes and thinking, but also a lot of money coming, especially from the U.S. to the Israeli alt-right machinery.
Okay, thank you, Uri. So I want to take up in a little bit the question of what the progressive camp looks like, what state it's in Israel, and where you think it's headed. But I want to just follow up on both of your sets of comments by asking, what do you see in the intermediate term? I agree with the L that we're at the end of the Netanyahu era, and one can see that sense of desperation, I think, perhaps most palpably in that absolutely shameful speech he gave after the indictment, inveighing against the deep state, even though, of course, if you look at the arc of Israeli history, his party has been in charge for much of the last 40 years. But one of the possible benefits of the immediate aftermath is that it will bring a kind of helpful measure of instability to the system, because Netanyahu brought, over the course of a decade, tremendous stability in terms of his personal stranglehold over institutions of government. And I'm wondering what you see as the next, to the extent that one can play this game at all, what do you anticipate, assuming Netanyahu will be gone, assuming that a coalition government, a unity government of some sort may take rise? What do you see in terms of stability and the possibility of coming back from that deep dark space of political vilification as of the enemy, of the rival, as just sort of the normal way of doing business. Is there a way to return, even in that interim period, from the dark depths of the Netanyahu era? Yeah.
So I think my honest answer would be that I really don't know, and I wish that I could predict the future. And I feel that it has to do a lot. Like, my analysis has to do a lot with the narratives I see, and whether I choose to be more fearful about things or more hopeful. There is a lot of when I look at the way in which the settlement movement has managed to penetrate the main places of power, in the media, in the army, in the public sector, and to advance its ideology and its interests, its very narrow interests, and many, many veins, then indeed it is scary. And I'm saying they're already, it's within the system, right? But then again, when I can also look at a more hopeful reality, and to see that in fact, because our public sector, unlike in the US, is not political, right? I mean, we have people in very senior positions, and it has nothing to do with their political affiliation or with their ideology, and with very long careers, and we see it with our security establishment and with all different organizations, and we see it in the ministries, that often you can actually reach a lot of achievements if you work not with the politicians, but you work with the pidut, with the
bureaucracy.
With the bureaucracy. Yes, thank you. And I think that once, like, Netanyahu will be out, the people will breathe. There is the sense of suffocation, of self-censorship, of, I am a proud lefty. There's nobody can not know that about me. And I would not consider trying to get a job in the public sector, because I know that nobody will take me because of my positions. And so that's sort of, I don't know if it's true or if it's not true, but it's my psyche, right? It's this idea that we're in the bottom of the food chain in a way, at least, I mean, in many ways, not also, it should be said, right? But the sense of being silenced, of not being able to express yourself, of being afraid of being exposed as a lefty in your workplace or so on, I think that will absolutely be erased very quickly with a different leadership, even with a unity government in Israel. I mean, just without having that Hamanhig, that leader.
The great leader.
Yeah, I think, in the last election, I said to myself that it's the first time that I really get fascism, that I really get how the public is cooperating. There was something that I've never really realized before. So I think that his removal from public stage, him being Netanyahu, will be extremely, will have a very great impact by itself. And the idea that the democracy and the institutions are stronger than the individual will send a very strong message. But at the same time, the systems are already in a way rigged. So it's hard for me to say something, to give a scenario with full confidence. But I know that the important thing is not what we predict, but what we do about it. And in that sense, we'll talk about like what we're building as a progressive movement in Israel. But I have great hope in one of the things that I think we realize is that we lack people in public sector. And there's now programs to train people and to really try to push people to take these positions. So that's just one, you know, example of the kind of actions that we're seeing. And the other thing that I want to mention is that I think that our political system currently is not organized in a way that is representative of where the people are. Again, because of Netanyahu, we are going to elections and again and again, and the elections are about whether we impeach Netanyahu or we don't impeach Netanyahu. And people, for example, to say it in very like practical terms, who are Meretz voters, like in all the Netanyahu era, would vote to the alternative to Netanyahu because it's more important to them to get rid of him than to have a party that represents their ideology, because the struggle against him is sort of dominating everything. And I think the way in which our parties are currently set are not representative of how our system should look in order to represent where people are. And that is also something that I think will change quite quickly. We'll still have a center because Israel has a very strong center, right, which is represented in blue and white, but we will also have shifts, serious shifts in how our left is organized, I think.
Thank you. Okay, I just want to remind everyone to please send along any questions you might have. Click at the bottom of your screen, the Q&A box, and write your question. Uri, I want to, in a sense, move to directly to the heart of our matter, which is what we can do and what the state of play is with progressive, liberal left organizations in Israel, which seem at some level to be absolutely decimated. We often labor under the belief, you know, that there's no substantial progressive voice. And if we look around the world, we see worrisome signs. We look at the choice that British voters faced in the recent election between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn, and we see the results of that election. And here we have tremendous trepidation about what will be in 2020 and who will be the candidate and whether Trump, weak and unpopular as he is beatable because of the structure of the Electoral College. What do you see in Israel, in terms of the current state of affairs and also what needs to happen in order to effect the kind of change that Yael was intimating at in her response?
First of all, there is a very developed, very impressive progressive infrastructure in Israel. I think it's a source of envy in a sense. You have organizations that despite the ongoing occupation and the security threats and everything, were able to build a chain of organizations focusing on human rights, on civil rights, on rights of minorities. But what I think is unique to where we at, that we are all caught, all this impressive infrastructure that, by the way, was supported throughout those years by NIF. Yeah. And I'll also mention NIF itself was caught by surprise by the brutal attack it suddenly faced, by a brutal political attack. Those organizations were built as good doers, checking data, collecting evidence, talking about formalistic, legal points of view. And all of a sudden they found themselves against this really impressive, brutal machine of a network of organizations that attacked them. And again, I go to NIF itself. It started, I think the point was just after Castled. I think that was the turning point of the attack on the progressive infrastructure in Israel. And all of a sudden you saw Naomi Chazan with a horn. And the NIF itself was flagged as, traitors, so on and so forth. And again, we're talking about a concentrated effort to basically break the resources of the progressive network in Israel. The two main attacks were against the NIF and against the European countries that supported the Israeli civil society and its work. By the way, the same way as European countries and the EU supports any human rights and civil rights organizations across around the world. But they knew what they were doing. They knew that by attacking NIF and the European government's aid to Israeli civil society organizations, they knew it's gonna really weaken this progressive infrastructure. Now, what we need to do.
Split the infrastructure. I mean, that's part of right the effect.
Split and also no, but you know, but basically dry the sources, the resources, the main ability to function. Now, by the way, they were more successful with the European governments, I think, and less successful with the NIF because the NIF started understanding what it needs to do and what we need to do, and that leads me to what we need to do is to understand what we are facing. To understand, I mean, for many of us. You know, those organizations that were established in the 70s, 80s, 90s, they're not equipped to fight this fight. We're talking about a fight that is heavily funded, that has, you know, facts and truth, much like, you know, from the Trump era now. You know, a few years back when I used to talk about it in the United States, people were looking at me, what are you talking about? Now people understand because they know this fake news and fake truth culture. And you're being attacked with, by the way, smart people who give very eloquent, vicious, populist statements and attacks. And you need to defend yourself. And the way to do it, the way that I adopted, is to fight back and attack them across the lines. I think you can't deal with those bullies any other way. I mean, you need to be on the attack constantly. Because, first of all, you know, once you attack them, they have to pull the resources from attacking you into defending themselves, like much like we've been doing in the last decade. And second, there's a lot of material to attack them with. I mean, these are organizations that have dark money around behind them. You know, they attacked us on the funding, as so-called it's foreign funding or whatever. They don't, you know, they don't say who is funding them. And the reason they don't say so is because they have many things to hide. So first of all, even the mere fact that they have something to hide is a great source of attack towards them. And also unveiling the those interests that stand behind their resources is also a way to shame them. And I think, you know, what we need to understand, and I think that won't go away after Netanyahu. I mean, I think definitely after Netanyahu, if I go back to your question to Yael, after Netanyahu, there will be an ease. No doubt about it. I think, you know, you'll have some silence from ministers like Miri Regev, Yariv Levin, Smotrich, all these people. And of course, Netanyahu himself and his son, by the way, who's a major player in the on the arena as well. You have some silence, but there's an infrastructure there. There's a machine there that is very strong, that is well funded, and that is not going anywhere. You know, we're now at the front for the protection of democracy. We're working on research showing how the American right is trying to implant American right-wing theories that are not part of the Israeli discourse at all, implant them into the discourse in Israel and discussion in Israel. For example, the right to bear arms, which is, you know, an American constitutional distortion, but it's there. It's not something that is part of our discussion. And all of a sudden you saw Minister Erdan, the Minister of Interior Affairs, adopting an ease of carrying guns. Why did he do it? We are now following the NRA and its footsteps in Israel. Also, abortions, which is an American, you know, political dispute. It doesn't have anything to do even with Judaism. All of a sudden, you see these multi-million dollar organizations acting against abortions in Israel. And of course, you have also, you know, libertarian concepts that, you know, Begin was not a libertarian. The Israeli right was not, it was perhaps not socialist and liberal, but never libertarian. All of a sudden, the right wing in Israel adopted this libertarian thinking also as an import and an active export from the United States into Israel. So my bottom line is we have to be on the attack. We have to also develop our ideological response to those attacks.
Great. Okay. So an important way, Yael, in which Uri understands the needs of the day is through his particular attack dog model, opposition research, and hitting back at the other side. I'm wondering how you see both the lay of the land in terms of the progressive world in Israel. What's the state of affairs, and what do you think is important to build? And here I want to just draw on a question that was raised by Alan Divak, which is, we haven't yet spoken about what seems to me sort of the operational credo of progressive Israel for the next half century, which is the idea of an Arab-Jewish partnership. So I'm wondering how you see the state of affairs today and where you think what alignment of progressive organizations can lead to the implementation of an alternative vision to the one reflected in the nation state law.
Thank you. So I'll highlight three things. There's probably many more. One of them, what I was referring to when I said that there are political system or political parties that do not reflect necessarily the way in which our progressive views of how we want or what will represent the constituency and a more not only accurate but also with more utility is basically this. Surrounds this idea of a Jewish-Arab progressive partnership, liberal partnership, and one of its expressions would be a party, and I say this with hesitation because I think that both Meretz and both Chadash will look at themselves as parties that have that. Partnership in heart in a
friends.
Way or some representation of it, or you know at least that's what they would like to represent, but it's not really a party that was formed to promote this idea that there is a camp of left people in Israel that are both Jews and Arabs. And that's certainly right it's a possibility for a political party. I will also say that I think that more important than having a political party, which I think maybe is something that is sexy to talk about, but more important is to have partnerships and to have the possibility of progressive Zionists and the Arab minority to work together, because there's no way to see in Israel a center-left government without opening the space and making it possible and legitimizing this sort of partnership. And it can happen in many spheres, not only on the between politicians, but also in civil society and education. There's a lot of work that could be done. And I think actually this is one of my greatest sources of optimism, because I think what we've seen in the last few months in Israel has been incredible in terms of the shift and the reaction to Netanyahu, the way in which the joint list and mainly Ayman Uda reacted in the last two cycles. Has brought people to really discuss this idea of as well as the nation state law is all part of it, has brought really to the center of public debate something that we didn't talk about for a while, which is how do we live together here, and what what are the boundaries of what we want to accept, how equal we are, how liberal we are, how democratic we really are. A very, you know, you hear in coffee shops conversations that might seem, I don't know, might seem not that far-reaching, right? Of people saying, why shouldn't we have Arab ministers in our government? You know, people are that are not political animals, but it's just like all of a sudden they think about why is it a problem? Like, why are Arabs a problem? Why can't they be have like an equal status in our institutions and so on? And there's more polls that are being conducted on it, and I think that the figures that we see, both by the way from the Arab minority in Israel or the Palestinian citizens of Israel, as well as from the Jewish majority, are quite surprising. There's still a lot of bad things that I can highlight in terms of people's willing to accept the Palestinian minority in Israel as equal partners in running the country. That's still, we're not there at all. But the discourse is years ahead of where it was really just a few months ago, which I think is a very good thing. The two other things that I want to highlight, one is that I think you said, you know, it's been again a Netanyahu decade. I've been in this business for about 15 years or so. I think Uri is right to say that we have a blooming civil society. It's amazing, and we have wonderful organizations dealing with human rights and with other issues, but we've neglected the political the politics. Also, as a generation, I'm saying this being critical of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we go to work in NGOs. We fight in legal ways. We fight in advocacy, but we're not pushing the politicians enough. And I see this in J Street. I see the way organizing is happening around the political sphere. It's not happening. It's not happening enough. But I think there's a realization that the political sphere has been neglected, and there's more and more, and there's more organizations that are thinking in advocacy terms, are thinking in mobilizing political, are thinking in terms of like political power, of how to gain political power and how to influence power, which is very different than how to win a case in court, or how to fight against the daily abuses of the occupation, and that also has to do with the training of people into political into like being either politicians or taking positions.
And it seems also important to think of the Pikidut, the civil service sector, as an important site in which to implement an alternative vision, given what you said, you know, how it would be unimaginable today that you would be a candidate for, you know, a senior professional position in ministry, which is of course ludicrous because you're uniquely qualified. And that has to be part of the change as well.
Exactly.
The electoral sphere as well as the professional functionary class.
And the third thing that I will say, and we'll keep it maybe to the next question, is to build this international infrastructure. And in particular, from where I stand, the Israeli-American, because the infrastructure, as also we mentioned on the right, is so powerful, and it's so organic, and the echo chambers are amazing. You know, I see the reactions that are coming from members of Congress in the US and from members of Knesset in Israel on the right, and they're using the same arguments. They're using the same language. I saw it just recently with the labeling of products, the decision of the High Court in the EU to label settlement products, and they use the same arguments. And I was asking myself, how come, like, who's sending them talking points about Tibet and Crimea and Western Sahara? And like, but there is this now, this like natural connection and relationship that was built through years of engagement and trust building, and realizing that that they share some interests and they can work on them, but then there's other things that they don't share and maybe they can leave them aside for now. And that's really something that we need to invest much more, both to counter them and to be more effective in what we do.
Great. So, okay, we'll get to this. We're now going to turn to, in the last 15 minutes of our conversation, to some of the questions that have come up. And I want to return to a point that both you made, Uri and Yael, and draw on a little bit more of Alan Divac's question and combine David Abraham's question, and ask, you know, what tangible change can we expect in March, especially with regard to Arab participation in the vote? So we saw between April and September a very significant rise in Arab voter participation from 48-49% to 60%, which is still far below, I think, the high of 75% in 1999. But is this, and this was something which NIF grantees, Zazim and Omdin Biyachad, were working assiduously on, and there were tangible, meaningful results. What's a reasonable expectation in terms of increased Arab participation for the March vote? And you know, how might that alter the outcome? How do you see
I think
here we're gonna we'll have shorter answers so we can take more questions.
Sure. I think we should expect another rise in Arab participation and Arab turnout. By the way, I think that's the fact that the Arab parties, now the joint party, were ousted and were kind of you know, isolated and not part of a possible coalition is it's like telling the Democratic Party to win an election without blacks. It's just, you know, it doesn't work. You can't do it arithmetically. I mean, the numbers. So I think Netanyahu was the best campaigner for Arab participation for the joint list. I think the fact that Ayman Oudeh and Ahmad Tibi and others played their cards very well in the last round between September and the dissolvement of the Knesset, and showing that they are more pragmatic and willing to participate. On the other hand, Blue and White, although, you know, Blue and White has different factions within it, but Benny Gantz, I should give him at least, if not excellent, but a good mark on the way he acted as well. I mean, he, unlike April, where he totally ignored, sometimes dismissed, and almost incited against the Arab voters and their representatives, this time he was very respectful. He mentioned them in all of the speeches he made. He met with them, took a picture with them. And this is on the background of a vicious attack by Netanyahu, and by the way, by Lieberman as well, who is the kingmaker. Yeah. But Gantz understood, I think, and it comes from politics, that in order to get a government, he has to have the Arabs on his side. So in that sense, it was the well-played game of Oden and Tibi and the rest of the joint list, and also the understanding of Gantz. I mean, that was the flow of events. And I do think that next time that, you know, in April, Meretz got many Arab votes because it came we had a glimpse of what could be the future, because Meretz in April is very different than Meretz in September. Meretz in April had a very left-leaning list with two Arabs out of the first five. That's for the first time in Israel's history where you have almost a balanced representation of Jews and Arabs. And you saw that Arabs reacted and 40,000 of them voted for Meretz. When Meretz pulled away from that, lowering the rank of Isawi Frej and Ali Salalcha, and also joining forces with Barak, who has a dreadful record with the Arabs, it lost some 60% of the votes it got in April. And right now we're, you know, as a Meretz activist, I can say we're in the eve of, forming the way we're gonna presented to the public. I think it will be somewhere in between April and September. It won't be as good as in April, but it won't be as bad, I would say, as in September. But I totally agree that the future is for a progressive Jewish-Arab cooperation. And by the way, that, you know, if you take the Arab joint list, some elements there are conservative. I mean, if there would have been Jews, they would be part of Shas, part of Likud, and even maybe part of the extreme right. There is a division within the Arab society, but because of the assault on them, they unite together, and I think that's what they should do. But what in a more healthy future, progressives should form together a big left-wing party that will be Jewish Arab, no doubt about it.
Okay, Yael, what do you see in March? And you know, there is tangible progress, as we said, the rise in participation, Gantz's change of tone. Is it conceivable that the joint list will be a member of will support a government and be an important player in that regard in the aftermath of the March election?
I wish. It's
we're so far away from that.
It was, yeah. I think we're so far away from. I mean, Blue and White say that they were seriously considering, or that there were discussions, and that it's really Lieberman that said, you know, this would not be possible, and made that so that that forming a coalition would be impossible, and will still most probably have the same. Similar results. I mean, the big change can come from the Arab list winning two or three more seats. That would be significant, but it still won't be. It still might not be enough to have 60 plus. So you'll still need, you know, a Lieberman or one of the ultra-Orthodox parties, and that's something that is hard to see, although we should have the political imagination that will allow us to.
That Haredim and Palestinian Israelis will represent 40-50% of Israel in in the next quarter century.
Right.
And they are joining forces in politics, in the Knesset many times. But it's a kind of behind the scenes cooperation. It's not, I mean, such a cooperation, as much as it's natural for progressives to join forces, also the Muslim faction within the joint list, together with Shas and the Haredi parties, very natural. Very natural cooperation.
Okay, I want to move, since we have a number of other questions, and I want to make sure we hear from those who took time to ask questions. Yael, I want to give you an opportunity to ask the question directed to you by from Michael Farrow. Would you care to make a response to the recent Intercept article criticizing J Street's effectiveness and influence, including the claim that you advised against the position of conditioning military aid because it might diminish J Street's influence on the Knesset? So,
sure. Thanks for the opportunity. I mean, it was a very long article. One of the things that was highlighted was this dynamic. I will say that. We have in J Street discussions on issues, and one of my jobs as the Israel director is to represent the position of how our who are our partners in Israel to the positions that we have. You know, how much we are in line, how much we're out of line, how it will affect our ability to not to influence the Knesset. I think that's the thing that was, for me, the most annoying about that that representation in the Intercept, that J Street does not influence the Knesset. Okay, J Street seeks support from Israelis. I mean, one of the greatest things we did when we supported the Iran agreement was bring Israeli security, not officials but ex-officials, to support the deal. And it was extremely, extremely helpful in getting the deal through, and something that I'm very proud of, you know, of doing, despite the fact that the deal did not get support across the Israeli political spectrum. I mean, for the most part of it. So So this is, you know, this is part of the role of my work in Israel. And when we make decisions, we take into account how it will affect the members of Congress, what the students think about it, what, you know, what our rabbis think. It's a very broad movement, and we have to take everything into consideration and also think what would be the greatest impact. And that was exactly it. I think we had to not only discuss the issue of aid because it's on the table, but also to, you know, to have a position. And the current position of J Street is that we call for transparency, and we want to make sure that the security aid benefits Israel's security and not Israel's occupation. And you know, that's a position that I feel very comfortable with.
Okay, so we have time for one final question from Tyler Grassi, and I want to just preface it by saying that we at NIF often imagine that we're confronting in the current moment two major crises. One is the crisis of democracy in Israel, which we've talked a lot about. The other is the crisis of a prospective lost generation of young American Jews in particular, who feel increasingly detached and alienated from the Jewish community, the established Jewish community, and from Israel. And so the question that Tyler asks is, what is the most practical way for progressive American Jews to be involved, to let Israeli Jews know, to Israelis know that we're standing behind them? And I would say, not only what is the most effective way that American progressives, Jewish and non-Jewish, can manifest their support from Israel, but what potential is there for that support to double back and have a reinvigorating effect on progressives, particularly progressive Jews in America? Let's see, whom shall we begin with? Let's begin with you, Uri, and then we'll conclude with Yael.
Sure. Look, I had about
2 minutes, 90 seconds to 2 minutes.
Okay, I had the privilege of living in the States for 4 years, so I think I know that, and I traveled all around, and I think I know the progressive Jewish community in the United States quite well. I would say the following. First of all, we have representatives here of the two major players in American Israeli progressive policy, and that's J Street and NIF, NIF and J Street. So I would advise first and foremost to be active in both these wings of how to promote policies through J Street and how to promote the actual work that Israeli nonprofits operate in Israel through the NIF. I think that's the best way to do it. Second, it's not about specific individual, but rather if we take a lesson from what's going on with the American right, is to understand that this is a kind of a, especially if you care about Israel, and understanding that the American right is using Israel as a kind of a testing field to many of its notions, Israel or progressives should also use Israel as this testing field on how you counter them. So it's not like any other foreign country to any progressive American, by the way, not only Jews, because as I said, there's no equivalent to the kind of cooperation between the American right and the Israeli right, and specifically for American Jews, and I understand that for right-wing and many times religious Orthodox Jews, it's easier to attach themselves with the current Israel, both with its political leadership and the constant occupation that is, making very hard, as Peter Beinart famously said, to check in your values when you enter Israel. It doesn't work like that. But, I hope that as American Jews, we care about Israel, and therefore we need to be active.
Okay, thank you. Yael, the final word, small question, what can American progressives, American progressive Jews do?
Right. So let me just say very, very quickly. I think that, this is, I'm obviously at the center of this, being a progressive Israeli that works for an American organization. I think that things are changing, that there is now much more Hadadiyut and an opportunity for us to be on much equal
reciprocity.
Exactly. I thought that everybody knows how to do it. And on much like equal grounds in a way, because we have a shared struggle. It's not only about Israel and the occupation. It's also about what is happening in the US. And it's also about the global rise of illiberal democracies or illiberal leaders. So there's this shift of us needing to understand that we are working together to goals that have to do with Israel and beyond. A second, building the trust between us, not a competition on who's progressive and who's not. What are, you know, there shouldn't be conditions for what is considered progressive and what is not, which I often think happens in this kind of relationship. Again, we should do our best to be able to form a line. And then there's very like practical, I think, ways of echoing each other, of providing support, providing accountability for positions that are taken in each of the sides, better echo chambers exactly to do that, opportunities to meet, sharing experiences, sharing lessons learned, sharing tools, legitimizing each other's positions, as I said, and really encouraging ourselves to educate ourselves about the other. I think in many ways Israelis have much work to do in learning about Americans in the same way that Uri had the opportunity to do when he was there, but most of us don't really know and care, and we should do much, much more of that. And also, you know, looking at Israelis not just through the eyes of the occupation, but also, you know, through everything that we struggle for as part of the progressive struggle here.
Yeah,
David, just one more comment that I forgot about it, and we're hosted by Partners for Progressive Israel. There's now in 2020, there will be elections to the Zionist Congress. Another way to influence is to vote for the joint progressive faction that has J Street, NIF, Meretz, and others, and voting for that. We can start the revolution from there, and it's a great way to bring together American and Israeli progressive Jews into action.
Thank you. So you have exemplified really what I think is perhaps the ultimate source of salvation, which is this kind of people-to-people contact. And if we can get particularly young Israelis and young American progressives together to talk about issues of mutual concern, whether it be the conflict or global warming, we will advance the cause in both realms. Unfortunately, there's much more to be said, but no time, so we're going to have to bring this conversation to an end. I want to thank Yael Patir and Uri Zaki for a really stimulating hour. Thank you to all of those who are viewing and listening to this conversation with Israel and Palestine. I want to thank the staff of Partners for Progressive Israel for their work in making this discussion happen, especially Dinesh. You can go to progressiveisrael.org to learn more about Partners for Progressive Israel and its future programs. Thank you, Uri. Thank you, Yael.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much. And thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Chag Urim Sameach.